Hi, everybody. I'm Keith Casey. After the water park party, I'm really sincerely impressed to see so many people here. There was a brief incident where I wasn't sure if I was going to be here, so I'm glad that I'm counting it as a win so far. So a couple calibration questions. Who's awake? Wow. Who's sober? Who's awake and sober? Okay, all right, just thought I should double check that just in case. Before I intro myself, I do want to say something about the people we have here. I've been to every That conference so far, and these guys, along with all the people Clark just fired, are a fantastic, fantastic group. I attend probably 12, 15 conferences a year, speak at a bunch of them, and this is hands down my favorite conference. This is the one that I look forward to all year long. This is the one where I kind of refer to it as a family reunion, where everyone is your weird uncle. Because look at Clark, come on. Doesn't he sort of fit the weird uncle mold? But it's an absolute blast. So this is the one I look forward to all year long. So anyway, I know that Clark and the entire team pour their hearts into this. So if you get a chance before you leave today, say thank you to one of them. You know, go up, give them a high five. Don't give them a hug unless they're into that. But definitely congratulate them because they've been doing this officially for 5 years, but planning for this starts well over a year in advance. So this is not something that is done lightly. And if you talk to them a little bit in detail, you realize, you know, at times there's houses on the line when you start trying to do something like that. I've been there, done that. All right. So if you want to find me online during this, definitely check out, I'm Casey Software just about everywhere. That's Twitter, Skype, LinkedIn, all those sorts of places. Now a little bit about myself. First of all, I'm a geek. I've been in the industry almost 20 years. This is the Library of Congress. My first job out of college was answering the question of how much data is in the Library of Congress. The answer is a lot. If we roll back to 2001 when I was there, we figured out if we digitized everything that the library had, if the entire staff worked on it 24/7, we'd be able to keep pace with the creation of new stuff. Remember, that's 2001. That's before the vast majority of media that we consume today even existed. At that point, our test database was about 300 gigs. That was 2001, remember? So that was actually a lot of data then. Now it's like, well, you download that every month. All right, next up, a few years later, I joined a company called Twilio. It was a little company at the time. I was number 25 or so. So that was a blast. I say little because now they're 500, 600, 7,000 people, I don't know. And they had a successful IPO a couple months ago, so that's great. Right now I work at Okta, joined there about 7 weeks ago, doing identity and security. But just to demonstrate how much of a geek I am, this is my son. He's 18 months old. His name is Quinn Alexander, also known as QA. I snuck that in while my wife was still under drugs. It worked out really well. Oh, and this picture was, this is his you're all going to pay picture. He got his glasses like 10 minutes before. All right. Closer to the presentation now. When I was growing up, I spent a lot of time in the Boy Scouts. I was actually a good Boy Scout, believe it or not. I spent a lot of time doing first aid, doing emergency preparedness, doing lifeguarding, like all those sorts of things. Even put out some fires. We're not going to talk about who started them, but even put out some fires, and that was always my focus. I always saw myself as this is an opportunity to like help people. One last thing about myself is I'm from the great state of Texas. Where are my Texans at? All right, we've got a few. They're kind of not awake yet, but we've got a few. And normally I throw in a joke about how Texas is different from everywhere else. I'm gonna take it a little bit different this time. I'm gonna talk about how Texas is actually similar to Wisconsin. First of all, Wisconsin has cheese. So do we. But we call it queso, which translates from Texan to English to mean cheese with good stuff in it. Next up, Wisconsin has cows. So do we, but we call them longhorns. And that's roughly to scale. That's ridiculously longhorns. And the final thing is, in Texas, we have these really strange neighbors to the north. And I heard in Wisconsin, you guys do too. All right, so now I'll get a little bit serious. Couple questions. Who here in the audience writes code for a living? All right, It's a good number of people. Who here manages people who writes code for a living? Okay, a lot less. Who refuses to raise their hand no matter what a speaker asks? All right, there's one back there. Thank you. I tricked you. So let me ask a question. If we were truck drivers, how would we be measured? Most likely we'd be measured based on how many miles we drove. If we were painters, house painters, if we painted insides of people's houses, we'd be paid and measured based on how many houses, how many walls we painted. So if our job is to write code, how should we be measured? Anybody? Lines of code! Who loves that idea? I see one hand back there. Okay. So by that reasoning, every time we use a framework, every time we refactor and we delete code, we are failing at our job, right? Every opportunity we have to write less code, we're actually failing. We're not sort of reaching our potential. We're not doing as much good stuff as we could do. And then we should probably be fired, right? If we follow that line of reasoning, we're fundamentally breaking things. It doesn't make sense. So can I safely assume that nobody agrees with that conclusion? Does anyone want to be, other than that guy back there, does anyone want to be measured by the lines of code we write? Okay. That's what I assume. Thank you. It's good to know. So one of our assumptions must be wrong. Either maybe our job is not to write code. So, well, sort of. What I propose to you is that code is just one part of our jobs. So I want to take a little bit different approach. But fundamentally, I don't even think code is the first part of our job. And I think sometimes it's actually the least important part of our job. So I want to flip it around a little bit. If our job is not writing code, what's our job? What? Solving problems, yes. Our job is to solve problems. And when we stop and think about it, we are problem solvers. Just the nature of who we are, we like to find problems. Sometimes we sort of wallow in those problems. But we want to find those problems, we want to solve them. So what we end up with is code is a tool. And it's fundamentally, it's not even the best tool we have sometimes. If we had a carpenter that only used a hammer, that would be a pretty bad carpenter, right? Because not every problem can be solved with a hammer, I don't think. I'm not a carpenter, so that's an educated guess. Instead, we need to stop and think and figure out how things work. And sometimes we just want to make things work better. We want to dissect things. So it's our job to explore, to create, to discover, to break things, to unbreak things, to fix things, and generally make our companies a better place. And so I want to expand that thinking and sort of say, okay, if our job is to solve problems, and we want to make our companies a better place, what can we sort of do elsewhere? How can we expand that? In fact, a bunch of us this week brought kids. Who brought kids this week? All right, a lot of you. This week you brought kids, and you exposed them a little bit to our world. You sort of got them in the shallow end, and you showed them, hey, look, here's problem solving. Here's these cool things. Here's what our industry can do. Here's the fun things that can go on. Here's how you can break things. Here's how you can explore and take risks in a safe environment with pretty minimal consequences. If somebody was doing a Minecraft mod and it broke, oh well, it's not a big deal. So I'm really excited about that possibility and that sort of potential that we brought to our kids. So I want to flip it a little bit and think about the Muggles. Because on the other side, there are 100 times as many people out there who don't have a clue what we do. They don't understand it. They don't get it. And I mean Muggles in the most affectionate way possible. Everyone's familiar with the term Muggles? I hope. Okay. I see a few people that are like, I have no clue. So in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter, the Muggles were the regular people who weren't the wizards. So the wizard world was almost totally separate from the Muggles. And the Muggles sort of did their thing. They had very little impact from the wizard world, except when bad things happened. So if you think of who shall not be named, Voldemort, whenever he did something bad, whenever he killed people, he was usually killing Muggles. So they got all the negative repercussions of the wizard world without a lot of the benefits. And if you think about it, that's how the vast majority of the rest of society is, right? When we screw up, when there's a major retailer that has a hack, fundamentally it's because somebody on our side made a mistake. And the people who suffer the consequences, the 40 million people that are affected in a particular hack, are the muggles. They get all the downside without even realizing the upside that they also got. So that's the way I'm sort of approaching and thinking these things. So these muggles don't have a clue what we do. They don't get it. They're the ones that when we come and visit for the holidays, they have us set up their Wi-Fi. A few years ago, they would have had us get rid of that blinking 12 off their VCR. Those are what the muggles, and I just dated myself, didn't I? That's what the muggles do. They don't get it, they don't want to get it, they don't know, they don't care. They just want the problems fixed. They need problem solvers, which conveniently, that's what we are, right? So going back to our job is the solving problems. So in this context, code is just a medium. Code is just one tool of the bunch. And frankly, it's just one of a lot of mediums that we can choose. And most of the time, it's not even the best. When we start thinking about the problems we're trying to solve, design and user experience are other mediums. They're other tools. Bots can be a medium. Requirements gathering, meetings, conversations, understanding are all mediums. The more we can figure out, the more we can understand what's going on around us and the actual context of the problem, the better off we're going to be. So when we consider these possibilities, we need to understand that it's just one of the tools in the toolbox. And no, your framework of choice does not solve that. I don't care what framework you use. I don't care what language you use. It doesn't make a difference. There are some problems that can't or just shouldn't be solved with code. And so this becomes even more true as our projects start to touch the real world. If you're doing CRUD on some enterprise system that three people use on a daily basis, and no one ever sees it, okay, maybe. Maybe this is not a problem that you have to be concerned about. But I hope that you're doing more than that. I hope that you're exploring. I hope that you're applying these ideas in new and creative ways. So more importantly, and this might need a warning, there are a lot of people out there who aren't like us. Whether we're talking about like technology use or intelligence or income or a variety of different things, people are all over the spectrum. Now, when I talk about technology and when I talk about all these things, I would wager that we're all on the far right side of that curve. Just by default, we are in the top few percent of people. We're doing things that other people don't even consider, don't even think about. And in fact, there's people in this room that are doing things that other people in the room don't even consider and think about. So we're on the far right side of this curve, and we're only getting further out. So in fact, if we constrain this just to technology, we'll realize that the muggles, the people who, you know, are loved ones in our lives, do not approach things, do not ponder or even think about things the way we do. There are people here that don't have Facebook accounts. There are people in our lives that have never logged on to Facebook. My grandmother lives in central Illinois in a small town, is absolutely terrified of Facebook. She says, well, I've heard that people can steal your data. I'm like, well, yeah, sort of, but you know, how can we approach that? How can we do things and build things in a way that is useful to these people without scaring the crap out of them? So there are people who don't have an interest in code. Believe it or not, people don't care about code. They care about having their problems solved. All right, so what do we do? How do we approach this? How do we understand this? How do we help the situation with our families, our loved ones, random people down the street that we will meet and that we'll interact with? And how do we solve these problems without looking like a giant jerk? Because nobody wants to have the person walk in and say, oh, well, here's the easy solution to that. Just do this and you're all good. No one wants that. So we came up with a few steps to approach that, and here's my plan. Step one is drop the word just from your vocabulary. Some context here. When somebody sits down with you and you have a question, you're saying, I'm really struggling with this problem. And somebody says, oh, why don't you just blah? That's kind of a slap in the face, isn't it? Now imagine you hear that regularly. Because what that phrase implies is, A, you're not smart enough and didn't think of it. Or B, well, they think this is such a trivial idea, they're shocked you didn't come up with it. That's kind of jarring to most people. And we tested this theory starting a few years ago. There's an event called Austin Hack for Change, ATX Hack for Change. And it's a social good hackathon that we do every year in May in Austin. And we started with this really simple hypothesis. We said, there are people in this world that understand the technology backwards and forwards. We just don't even think about how well we understand it, how, like, to the depth or to the all of those sorts of aspects. But as much as we know the technology, we don't know the problems that are facing the local citizens, the city, anything like that. And then there's the people who are the exact opposite. They know the problems. There are social workers, there are adoption agencies, there are nonprofits, there's homeless shelters who understand the problem backwards and forwards. They deal with it literally every day, but don't have a clue of the technology. They don't get it. It's just so far outside their realm of expertise, they just don't have a clue. So we start with this hypothesis of there's these two groups. What if we gave them a framework? What if we gave them some understanding on here's how to interact? Here's the language that each side uses. And we said, okay, if we say they're smart people on both sides, we help teach them here's how to interact, here's how to communicate, and we put them together, amazing things will result. So it's kind of a big hypothesis, and so we tried this out starting the first time in 2013. And 20 projects came and presented. We spent a lot of time grooming the nonprofits to sort of speak the right language before we got there. By the time they got there, they had some projects. Of the 20 projects that started, 18 actually completed something by the end of the weekend. And this wasn't just a normal hackathon. This wasn't, hey, come build something, and then the project dies on Sunday night. Our big focus was, is this project still alive 3, 6, 12 months later? Did the team that was building something for these nonprofits give them the documentation, the support, the understanding to be able to take this project forward? So 20 teams came in and presented something. 18 actually finished something by the end of the weekend. 15 of those were still moving 6 months later. It was kind of amazing. And we had everything from the Girl Scouts, which they actually recruited a team using Girl Scout cookies. I thought that was kind of like A-plus level effort there. You know, talking about using all the tools in your toolbox. We had a group that's called Keep Austin Fed. They're probably one of my favorite groups in the world because what they do is normal restaurants can't just take their food and drop it off at a homeless shelter because of health code rules and all this other stuff. It's actually illegal for them to do that. But what they can do is if somebody shows up at their restaurant, they can just give them the extra food at the end of the night. So they came up with a system where they could send a text message at the end of the night and say, hey, we have food, we have breadsticks left over. That text message would go out to a network of people and say, hey, there's breadsticks at this restaurant available. That message also could go to a local homeless shelter or food bank and say, hey, we have this food available. So then somebody in that random community of people would go pick up the food, and they get a text message from the homeless shelter saying, hey, please drop the food off here. So the restaurant was not giving food to the shelter. The shelter wasn't accepting food from the restaurant. The restaurant was giving food to somebody in the community, and somebody in the community was dropping off food at the homeless shelter. And that's kind of cool. It's kind of silly we had to go to that complexity, but it's really kind of a cool thing. So with just a little bit of technology and understanding the laws and how to get around them, let's be honest. You know, we were able to solve a really simple problem in a really kind of elegant way. It didn't take much to do. The second step that I have in here is we need to understand that not all help is helpful. So one of the things that I heard a conversation this morning where somebody says, oh, I'd like to volunteer and get involved. And the person that was running the organization said, well, first thing we'll do is we'll have a conversation. I'll tell you what's involved. And then if you're still interested, you'll have the opportunity to get involved. And that's a kind of an interesting thing because as much as we want to say every contribution is important, not every contribution is valuable. And sometimes it's not valuable, period. And sometimes it's not valuable at that particular moment. We need to understand that. And that's not a judgment that there's a bad person involved. It's just a judgment of not every problem needs your particular skills at that particular moment. So when I was in college, I was in ROTC for a couple years, and I studied battlefield medicine. I worked under a master sergeant, a fantastic guy. Whenever you called him sir, he said, no, I work for a living. He was that kind of guy. He said lots of other things that shouldn't be streamed. I'll share those with you later. And it was the kind of thing where we sat down, and when we talked about battlefield medicine, and I did my final exam, I got perfect scores. Like he said a number of colorful words, and he said, that's a blankety-blanky job, great job. As much as my training is useful there, I've had exactly zero chances to apply it. Now, I'm ready to. There might be a time to. I hope there's not. But it's the possibility that just because you have a skill doesn't mean it's going to be useful in that particular time, in that particular problem. So just like if you're really good at user experience, if you're really good at web design, when you step in and try to help somebody, help an organization, help whatever, you have to understand that as great as you are, that might not be where they need your help. And that's kind of a painful thing. I worked with a guy years ago where he said, oh, well, I don't get involved with nonprofits or with groups like that unless I can do what I do in my normal job, because here's my billing rate, and that's what I value my time at. I said, well, that's great as long as everyone needs a Cisco network engineer to help out. Most groups don't need that. Sometimes a group just needs you to carry that box from over there to over there. So it's kind of a humbling experience understanding that, you know what, even then, like, even not just our code is the right tool for the job. Sometimes our skills aren't the right tool for the job. Sometimes they just need a strong back to be able to carry things. So we need to understand that our skill set won't match perfectly sometimes, and that's totally okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But a key part of this is a little bit of humility. We have to be willing to set aside where we are, what we want to do, our dreams and aspirations, just to get the job done. Because sometimes moving that box, moving that, you know, cleaning up that room, whatever, is a key thing. We need to remember that. That job has to be done just as much as everybody else's. And finally, we have to realize that there's already groups out there that need our help. So every time I start talking to a community and they say, oh, we want to get involved and do this, almost without exception, people say, I'm just going to go do this. So they show up somewhere and they say, I'm here, I'm ready to volunteer, I'm ready to do this, without a lot of planning, without a lot of forethought. And that's kind of broken, because fundamentally, as much as our skills are useful, we have to apply them in useful ways. And they don't always make sense. We don't always see it. So there's this great quote by this philosopher named Uncle Ben. With great power comes great responsibility. So I see it as our responsibility to step in and help these groups. But to help them in the way they need, not in the way we think they need. If we walk in and say, oh, why don't you just blah? They're going to say, oh yeah, you're just another person in here telling us how to do things. And we're forgetting the fact that they're dealing with this problem and this understanding every single day. They know more about this problem, or even better, they've forgotten more about this problem today than we've probably known up to this point. And what's funny is this quote actually, we know Uncle Ben is the one that said it, but this is actually a biblical quote. It's from Luke 12:48. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded, and from the one who has been entrusted with much, more will be asked. So this is not a new concept. Everyone wants to say Uncle Ben is the man here. Well, this goes back quite a bit further. So in this regard, I want to talk about a great place called Texas. So who's from Texas again? I saw a cluster over there. Okay, there's a handful of people here and there. So unless you're from Texas, you probably aren't tuned into Texas news. 3.5 years ago, there was this thing in West Texas. So this is an apartment building. There was a fertilizer plant that somebody decided to light on fire. Fertilizer plus fire is a really bad combination, okay? It's a horrible combination. The Oklahoma City bombing, for example, was fertilizer-based bomb. And in this thing, 15 people were killed. This is a horrible, horrible situation. This is an aerial view. I believe this was the day after, so all the fires had gone out. Later that year in Austin, we had what are known as the Halloween floods. This was a crazy, stunning thing, because like, just the number of houses that were destroyed as a result of this was just absurd. I think there were 100 in this one, but that wasn't the only time. This was Memorial Day last year, but it could have actually been Memorial Day this year too. And these are just natural disasters. There's not a lot of stuff we can do about it. And if you're like me, you see stuff like this on the news and you go, oh my God, this is horrible. Like, there's these terrible things happening. And when it happens right there in your community, it's even worse. This is Lamar Street, a street that I drive down regularly. If you're familiar with Austin at all, the Whole Foods mothership, I mean headquarters, is like 3 blocks south of here. And this is an entire neighborhood. That's a street all the way up. That's like 6 blocks of water. And this has happened twice in 2 years, twice in 13 months. This is crazy. So around that time, I started digging around and I said, okay, I want to help. I want to get involved. How do I do that? You know, I want to use my skills. I want to use my powers for good, not evil. You know, I want to do something useful. And I found this group, Austin Disaster Relief Network, ADRN. Fantastic, fantastic group. It's a network of about 100, 150 churches in and around Austin and Central Texas. And their whole thing is they want to be able to bring together emergency prepared people. So everyone in the organization has basic emergency preparedness training. Some people have first aid. Some people have CPR. Some people have crisis counseling. There's ham radio operators. Like, if stuff goes down, they're ready to deploy. And so probably the most useful thing about this organization is every single one of us has had this emergency preparedness training, background checks, things like that. And so when a natural disaster happens and the like Austin Police Department sets up that yellow tape, or the Red Cross sets up that yellow tape and says, you can't cross here, we're actually credentialed to cross that line. We're actually credentialed to go in and help people. Whether it's flood, fire, tornadoes, even apartment buildings burning down, we're able to go in and stop the bleeding. And some of us are trained to do it literally. Another thing is we've had, there's been a couple apartment buildings burning down, and ADRN has stepped in while the building's still on fire and just sat with the people watching their lives go up in smoke and just been there, brought them a cup of coffee and had that conversation of, are you okay? And it's really kind of a terrifying aspect. I've never had to do that, but it's a terrifying aspect having to sit down with somebody and say, are you all right? This horrible thing just happened to you. Did everyone make it out alive? Is everyone okay? How do you have that conversation? It's not something we're prepared for. It's not something we think about on a regular basis. Unless we've been directly impacted by this, it's not something we've done. And so there's groups like ADRN that do that. But in talking with some of the volunteers and some staff in the field and some of the survivors, figured out there were some gaps, figured out there were some places that they need help. Figured out the systems behind the scenes actually needed some work. So by getting in at this ground level, I started doing some exploring and dug. And I found out that when a disaster happens, whether it's a flood or fire or tornado or even an apartment building, the first thing they do is they have a big red button, similar to our big red buttons in the sessions, which automatically calls everybody together to stand up a call center. Makes sense, right? I mean, when somebody has a problem, they need to be able to call somebody and figure out where to get help. That call center happens to be Cisco phones using Twilio. As soon as I heard that, I was like, whoa, wait a minute, I can do something here. So after they go ahead and deploy that call center, they send staff out to the field to figure out what's going on. They hand each of them an iPad, and there's a mobile app on that iPad to be able to assess what's going on, to take pictures, to be able to input survivor information to say, here's a list of everyone who is affected. Well, wait a minute, I know how to do that. Behind the scenes, when they figure out, or when they try and figure out who to send out to the field, it's a WordPress app. That's how they track their membership. Oh, wait a minute, that's useful. And then I dug in and I found out, well, how are you tracking training to figure out who to send out to the field? That's a Java app. They have a JSP app sitting behind the scenes where they're capturing all this information. But without actually going out and talking to these people and seeing these people in action, I wouldn't have figured out any of that. And as we were digging into this, as we were exploring, we found that there's a lot of gaps in there. There's a lot of places where the data is not moving back and forth, where phone calls are dropping occasionally, where data is not being synchronized, where files aren't being synchronized. The first thing I did was I got them set up on this great thing called Dropbox. Because before that, they were using an FTP directory to send things back and forth. So now they've got really granular access control to be able to say, you have access to this folder, but not this folder. I wouldn't have realized that was possible or that was available or that was a need until I sat down and figured out, oh, what are you doing? What are the problems you're running into? One cool side thing about ADRN is they've been so successful and they've been sort of with the Red Cross and City of Austin and everything sort of endorsing them. They've been lifted up as a model. So there are 11, I think 11 or 17 other cities deploying the exact same model across the country. A number in Southern California to deal with wildfires and things like that. So it's not just, my initial goal when I got there was just help move stuff and help carry stuff and help clean things up. And I realized, wait a minute, there are gaps in the technology. There are places I can help. And now I'm figuring out, oh, wait a minute, since this model is working, they're starting to deploy it across, you know, 11 or 17 other cities to figure out, here's how to solve this problem at scale. When I walked into this group, I had no clue that that was on the roadmap. I had no clue that there were that many people that could be helped as a result of me just setting up Dropbox for them. That's kind of cool. And you know what? There are dozens and dozens and dozens of organizations out there that could use us to do these sorts of things. So one of the things that we also found was that we found that the average intake for a survivor, when somebody, a volunteer goes out to the field and starts taking their information, the initial input took 8 hours. It took manual synchronization. They would take pictures of forms and email them back to the office over their phones. That's broken. Just by converting a few things to an app, after we understood the process, after we understood what was going on, we were able to optimize that, and now it's down to about 4 hours. So 4 hours after whatever terrible event happens, we're able to start helping people. I think that's kind of cool. I think that's kind of amazing. We want to tighten that. We want to get that faster. But realistically, we're pretty excited with what we've got so far. And so the only thing, the only metric that really matters to us, it's not website performance, it's not monthly active users, it's not Twitter followers, it's none of that. In fact, we want our monthly active users to be zero, right? Because if we have zero active users, what does that mean? That means nobody's hurt, right? That's a good thing. That's what we want. So the only thing that matters, the only metric that we had in this case was how quickly somebody went from the disaster happening to how fast we were able to help them. That's the only metric that mattered. So realistically, we didn't care if the system supported one or 100 people as long as we were able to help them quickly. So we were running into the problems where people were seeing their entire lives destroyed. They're seeing their houses wiped out, flood, fire, tornadoes, whatever. And they had to figure out how to pick up the pieces. So every minute, every hour that we could speed that process along was not just vitally important to us. It wasn't a pride thing for us. It was like, how fast can we help these people out? How fast can we move them along to get them out of the state of their world has been destroyed, there's no hope, to, you know what, there's people out there who care about me. There's people out there that can help me. That was the only metric, that was the only thing we cared about. And you know what? None of these people, well, I assume, none of these people know about code. They don't know about code quality. They don't know about API design. They don't know about server uptime. They don't know, they don't care. That's not even in their realm of possibilities at that point. That's not even in their like thought process. All they know is that my house, my family, whatever, just had this horrible tragedy happen. How are things going to get better? And it's kind of humbling to think about. No matter how good we did our job, they don't see most of that. And honestly, they don't care about most of that. So we're just worried about how quickly we can help them. And that's the thing I sort of want us to remember. Like, in our 9-to-5 jobs, we're working on these things. And we try and figure out, okay, how am I having an impact on the world? You know what? Sometimes our 9-to-5 job won't have that. And that's perfectly fine. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with that. I've had lots of jobs like that, and they just sometimes suck. But you know what? Paying the bills is a good thing. And many of us will never work on the things that change the lives of individuals or help families, like, recover or improve or anything like that. So what? If we're not doing that in our jobs, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. There's a lot of other places we can do that. So Jeff Blankenberg stood on the stage about 4 to 8 hours ago, and he said that our biggest problem is poor prioritization. It's not time management. It's not anything like that. It's just doing the things that matter and being deliberate about the choices we make. So I want to leave you with this. Do you want to write code, or do you want to solve problems? So thank you.